Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and joining us from Anchorage, Alaska, is my co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. We had a little adventure, you and I, yesterday after the start that I'm sure we'll go into in a few moments, but just wanted to update people that the 2019 Iditarod is well underway, and currently, as we're taping this on Monday afternoon, I'm looking at the tracker, and it looks like Nick Petit, Pete Kaiser, Yor Leifseth Olsom, and Ali Zirkel and Ryan Reddington are the front of the pack, and they've gone almost 200 miles in just a little bit over a day.
Yeah, they're looking real good out there. We're about 24 hours into the race, and I tell you what, we thought it was going to be a pretty slow start with the weather. You and I were down on the trail a little bit, but the trail looked real nice, and I think they're rocking and rolling out there.
Yeah, it looks like it's I also thought that it might be a bit of a slower race this year, but it looks like, you know, some teams took a while longer than usual to get to Yetna, the first checkpoint, but it looks like after that, we've got a lot of teams really going at a pretty good clip.
We do. So let's talk a little bit about our adventures yesterday. It was your first time up the Big Sioux and Yetna River to the Yetna River or the Yetna Station checkpoint, the first checkpoint of the Iditarod. We were there quick enough to see the first teams come in. Tell our listeners a little bit about your experience yesterday.
So we went down the trail on a snow machine, and a lot of people do that early in the trail. Some people do that for the entire length of the race. It's it can be tricky in a few points because the trail is not very wide, and there are some times where obviously the dog teams running have the right of way, so you have to be careful to yield to dog teams, to not get too close to the dog teams, all of that. But in spite of that, there was an opportunity to have some actual short conversations with the mushers as we went by them and they went by us. And that was kind of fascinating. You know, we weren't having philosophical debates, but there was enough time to have like a couple of sentences back and forth. And that's kind of an unusual thing. You don't really get that with, you know, with a professional basketball or football game. But because mushing is such a spread out sport, and the Iditarod is going to go, you know, almost 1,000 miles, there is the opportunity for you to get very close to the competitors and to actually interact with them. And I think that's really cool.
It was awesome. You and I and our friend Miranda took a couple of snow machines out and went on the first 40 miles of the trail. And as we talked about yesterday or the day before, they switched up the first part of the trail. It didn't go down the infamous Correll Hill. It went down what they call the Raleigh Creek Trail, then hit the river a little bit further down. What was your experience on the river there? I know it was quite bumpy, but it's a beautiful country, isn't it?
It was really amazing, and I read about and experienced a little bit closer to the start a kind of party atmosphere in the trailgating that goes on the Iditarod Trail, and it was really fun to see a lot of these things that I'd heard about but hadn't experienced. So, for example, there was something called, I believe, the Pink Flamingo Camp or Camp Pink Flamingo or something like that, where there were hundreds and hundreds of pink flamingos set up on the ice, and people were barbecuing, people were having bonfires on different rivers or on the sides of rivers. and really just there to root on their favorites and to cheer pretty much everybody on as they went past. And, you know, that again is one of the things that I love most about mushing and the Iditarod, is that even though people definitely have their own personal favorites, it's more like they are rooting for everyone and they want everyone to do well. And it feels like that's very unusual. We seem to all be divided up into our own little tribes, and we each tribe hates all of the other tribes, but I don't really find that in mushing at all.
Right. And as we said, we arrived just in time for the mushers, the first batch of mushers to come in there at Yetna. And it was a madhouse in the little roadhouse there at Yetna Station. And I remember the owner of the roadhouse there, his name is Dan. He was hollering and screaming, "Okay, they're 2 miles out. Everybody take their positions." And they had what they call the couch potato gang. And I thought that was pretty cool. All of the kids that are there at the checkpoint ran out and were sitting on a couch on the river. And they have a job to do. They're calling out numbers to the checkers. They're saying, bib number 14's in with 14 dogs at the time of 4:49 and that sort of stuff. And then they collect their bibs and then they give those bibs back to the mushers at White Mountain. I did not know that. I thought that was really cool. And then what I also thought was really interesting is in the corner of the roadhouse, way back in the back, was a lone woman, and she was sitting there with a radio and a computer screen, and they were having internet problems because out there at Yetna they're on a generator or solar power and the internet kept going down. And I remember seeing that on Facebook. They kept saying, "Well, why is the internet fading out? Why is the internet fading out?" It was for that very reason. We were seeing it in real time. But anyway, this one woman pretty much was in total control of the tracker updates and the comms and all that. I expected a much bigger workforce behind that whole communication system, didn't you?
Yeah, and I think as it goes towards some of the larger checkpoints, you know, the places like McGrath and Unalakleet where it's easier for people to fly in and out, I think you find the comms has a lot more people, a lot more volunteers doing it. But as you said, it was basically that one woman in the corner, and you know, they were constantly turning lights on and off and trying to make sure that they weren't overloading their system and blowing fuses and that sort of thing, because with the generator that would take out like a whole half of the house or something. So that was really cool. And it was fascinating to see when we got there. It was still like the calm before the storm, because everyone was inside. There were a ton of kids there. The people were playing with a few of the house dogs and stuff. And it just seemed very chaotic. And then as soon as the first musher started approaching, you know, the owner of the roadhouse would yell out, you know, "Mushers at this place, and they're coming down the sluice," and this sort of thing. So they knew approximately, you know, 5 or 10 minutes out before they would come, and then they would all you know, run outside to do their jobs. And in addition to the checkers and people keeping track of, you know, who was where and when people left and how many dogs they took with them, they're also at most checkpoints are veterinarians or vet techs who are doing spot checks on a lot of the dogs as they come through.
One little bit of a behind-the-scenes story about what we saw yesterday on the river. You and I and Miranda headed back at about 8 o'clock, and we were working our way back down the river, and just about everybody at that point had made their way into Yetna Station and checked in and checked out relatively quickly. Only a few of them stayed for a short camp. But I remember seeing at about 10 miles or so from the checkpoint, there was a lone musher, and he was sitting there on his cooler. It was pitch dark, and the lights were shining on him from a very big TV-style camera from the Iditarod Iditarod Insider. And there, as we passed, he was just kind of sitting there on the cooler with these bright lights shining on him in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the dark. And I guess that's what they do. You can't escape the cameras even in the middle of nowhere, can you?
No. And, you know, it's both a good thing and a bad thing, because it's a good thing in that the insider really gets a lot of sort of up close and personal coverage of the mushers. But at least to my eye, when we passed it, that musher did not look very happy. It looked like he would much rather have been resting or doing whatever it was that he pulled over to do rather than having to talk to the insider right then.
Right. It reminded me of B-Real on like a reality show or something like that, because they weren't talking. He was just kind of sitting there with his hands on his knees, and, you know, he kind of lifted up an arm to give us a wave, but they were not doing any interviews as we drove by. So it was really just a one-sided conversation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. That's both good and bad. I mean, the insider has the right to do that, and the mushers agree to interact with the insider when they sign up for it. I think if anyone else had been doing that, they might have gotten a piece of the musher's mind, or they might have been told to to buzz off or what have you. But this is the way it's set up.
Well, so let's talk about that. We had mentioned that this morning before you headed back down to Anchorage about a sign you saw that was posted during Iditarod handler, volunteer training, that said that they are not allowed to take any type of Facebook Live or live video or pictures or of anything at checkpoints because it's copyrighted media property. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it's an interesting and strange thing, and I definitely feel like there is a little bit of overreaching in this, because the sign, I believe it's Channel 2, has paid a fairly large amount of money to be the official media company that's covering events like the start of the Iditarod. So they don't want people to be able to just get that information from the start of the Iditarod without going to, the company that paid for this access. And there's a couple of things too. In years past, a lot of the volunteers seemed much more concerned with getting pictures of their favorite mushers and their dogs and all these behind the scene pictures, which you would want as a fan. And at times that kind of interfered with them doing their volunteer jobs, which is really what they're there for. So I understand the idea of not wanting the volunteers to do these things, to take pictures or to take video when they're supposed to be doing their job. But this went a little bit further, and it not only said that the volunteers absolutely could not do Facebook Live, whether they were working or not working, but also that race fans could not do Facebook Live. And I don't know that that is at all enforceable, because if you are somewhere on a public place and you're not on private property, I think you have the right to record and broadcast what is going on there, even if the Iditarod would rather that you didn't.
You know, and when we spoke this morning, I had pretty stout views about this. I think it was totally wrong to be able to try to enforce something like that. And like you said, it's nearly impossible to enforce in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. But just for them to say that this is a branded, copyrighted media product, it just speaks to me like they're trying to control all access to this. And that really speaks to the corporateness, if that could be a word, of the entire race, where they're just trying to control everything. And that's just one of those things that gives a bad taste in my mouth towards Iditarod, and I just don't like that.
Yeah, and you know, I think a number of people have said that they're trying to control the brand, and in trying to control the brand, I think they're infringing on some of the things that the fans love about the brand. And one of the things is that it is so accessible and it's so easy to get to these people and to, you know, become a part of, feel like you're a part of this event. And I think personally that if you're broadcasting stuff from Iditarod, if you have, you know, a little Facebook Live about a musher coming through or a musher starting or a musher at a certain checkpoint, I think that only helps. I think that helps sort of, you know, reinforce the brand and it helps kind of emphasize what makes the Iditarod such a special event. So I understand why they're doing this, but I don't think that I think it's ultimately a bad idea.
Well, we would love to hear what our fans and listeners have to say about this. Please leave us a comment over on Twitter or Facebook or any other social media under the name Dog Works Radio. We're under that handle on all social media. We would love to hear that. And we're getting quite a bit of comments back and forth on social media this year. I think that is the name of the game. I know there's been a lot of articles about mushers on the trail that are being very effective with social media, in particular Blair Braverman, who has taken sort of the world by storm on Twitter with her storytelling and social commentary there on social media. I think it's really gone to the next level, hasn't it?
It really has. And, you know, it's interesting that there's a lot of stuff that you can learn from being on social media, and a lot of mushers are starting to use it more. Some do it very effectively, some do not. I think almost everyone could take a page out of Blair Braverman's book, because she does it extremely well.
Right. So what other news do you have before we jump over to our musher profile segment?
So did we talk yesterday about the restaging of the start and moving the dog trucks, or did we not talk about that?
We briefly mentioned it. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I thought that was pretty interesting when we saw that there at the Willow Community Center.
Yeah, so usually the trucks are staged, the dog trucks are parked on the ice very near the shore, and you know, in any given year there will be at least one dog truck per team, and there are a couple of teams that have more than one truck. And so then you know, for this year we had 52 teams, so you would expect, you know, between 52 and 60 dog trucks. And it was deemed that the ice was not safe to support that much weight from the dog trucks. So there had been some breakup in the ice on Willow Lake after the earthquakes. So it was decided that it was not going to be a good idea to park all those dog trucks there. There had been a couple of snow machines, I think, that went not into Willow Lake, but into another nearby lake. And some people were saying that, you know, this was more out of caution and a fear of Iditarod being sued if something happened to somebody's truck. But in any event, they staged the dog trucks in the parking lots that are closest to the community center, and that's usually parking for like VIPs and some media people and the real early birds who get there at like 6:30 or 7 the day of the restart. So that area was all taken up by the dog trucks. So everyone had to park in the big parking lots that they have across the highway and walk over. And then rather than having the start, you know, somewhat down on the lake, I believe the start was right at the point where you go from the land onto the lake, or very near there, and then ran across Willow Lake. I heard one interesting story this afternoon, which is that when they do the restart in Willow, the media has access to the staging area where all the dog trucks are and all of the mushers until 1 o'clock. And then the media you know, herded out of there so that the mushers can have their, and the handlers can do their final preparations before they start at 2. And apparently Mitch Seavey had wandered out of the staging area and gone to the community center or gone to talk to somebody and left the protected area of the, where the trucks were being staged, and didn't have either his identification card, his like laminate, or his armband that identified him as a musher. So when he tried to get back into his dog truck, he was initially stopped, and the security people, who were perhaps a little bit overzealous, would not let him back in to his dog truck and his dogs. And then someone had to come and vouch for him and, you know, reassure them that this was okay, that this was a 3-time winner of the Iditarod and was actually a musher and should be allowed back there. So, in this case, it's someone taking their job and their responsibilities maybe a little bit too seriously and not realizing who they were dealing with. And I find that kind of an amazing backstage story of Iditarod.
You know, I hadn't heard that. It reminds me of something like in Hollywood or trying to get into an exclusive club, and you go up to the doorman or the bouncer and you say, "Hey, my name is Jim Smith. Honestly, it is, for real. That's who I am." And them just not handling it, or just not taking that word for what it's worth. And he's lucky he got back in. It could have turned out to be disastrous for missing his spot, because if you miss your spot, you have to go last.
Yeah. Yeah. Has that ever happened?
I don't know. I don't follow it closely enough to know if that has ever happened. I know it's happened several times in much smaller races. In sprint races, it's very common if you miss your spot, because they go out every 2 minutes. And if one person is just a couple of minutes late, it really bogs up the entire system. And so they just push them to go last. And I think that's a pretty effective policy.
Yeah.
So who is our musher profile for this evening, Alex?
So tonight we're going to talk about Michi Kono, who was born and raised in Japan and speaks mostly Japanese. He speaks a little bit of English, but is mostly in Japanese. And he started mushing about 25 years ago, and he was doing sprint racing and started by leasing a sprint racing team from Joey Reddington. And he finished in first place in the 1998 North American sprint races in Fairbanks. And as a result of doing that, he was granted a green card and moved permanently to Alaska at that point, started building up his own kennel. At one point, he had 70 sprint racing dogs in his kennel. And he did that for a few years, and then he got rid of his dogs. He sold off all of his dogs and rehomed all of the dogs so that he could retire from sprint mushing and focus on being a tour guide, taking Japanese tourists around various places in Alaska, going hiking and camping in national parks in the western part of the U.S., but he'd always had it nagging at him that he should run the Iditarod. And Joe Reddington Sr. told him that it didn't mean anything unless you run the Iditarod. So he had that in the back of his mind that he wanted to run the Iditarod. And Joey Reddington had died shortly before Michi's rookie year, which was last year in 2018, and was the honorary musher that year. So for Michi, getting to Nome and completing the race was not only meaningful for him, but it was meaningful as a tribute to the man who had mentored him and had introduced him to mushing and started him out as a sprint musher. In 2018, Blair Braverman and her husband Quince Mountain decided that there weren't enough Michi fans at the start, and there apparently hadn't been anyone who had come over from Japan to root him on at the start. So they declared themselves his rooting contingent for the Iditarod, and they went around telling everybody about Mishi and getting the word out about Mishi. And this year, before the ceremonial start in Anchorage, he had a Japanese flag on the back of his sled. And the cool thing about, and a lot of mushers who come from other countries will have the flags on the back of their sleds, at the ceremonial start, and then they'll have them in Willow and sometimes take the flags on the trail. But this flag in particular was signed by a bunch of his friends and supporters from Japan, who sent the flag over here so he could carry part of his Japanese heritage with him when he's running the Iditarod this year.
Pretty cool. I definitely wanted to make sure we profiled him on the show when I saw him there at the ceremonial start. Again, that just kind of speaks to what we do on this show is to talk about those mushers who do not get that type of coverage, like the Mitch Seavies and the Lance Mackeys and the Martin Boosers and the like. But I do have to say, I was looking at his Instagram profile this morning when I decided that we were going to talk about him, and I'm going to put a tag to that over on our show notes page. He's quite the adventurer. He really gets out and about, and he does many things in the outdoors, and I think people will really enjoy checking out some of his pictures.
Yeah, and apparently has had quite a thriving guiding business for taking tourists, not only Japanese tourists, but primarily Japanese tourists all over the place on various adventures.
Very cool. All right, Alex, we're just about out of time. What's going to be happening over the next 24 hours or so? I think that most of them will be over the Alaska Range by the time we talk tomorrow. Many of them are already through the infamous Happy River Steps, which is pretty much just a cliff down a gorge, and it can prove to be quite precarious for a lot of mushers, especially those in the back of the pack, because the trail just gets so chewed up as they're working their way down what they call the Happy River Steps. But I think that everybody will be well on their way and on towards Roan and well past that by tomorrow, right?
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see is a bunch of the front of the pack people like Nick Petit and Pete Kaiser and Yor and Ryan and Allie. I think that once they get to Roan, I would expect that a lot of them are going to be taking fairly long rests there because they've been really just going for it and pumping through. And I think at a certain point, the dogs are just going to need rest. And as we always note, if you push your dogs too hard in the beginning, they'll tend to falter. So, you want to be sure that you're pushing your dogs enough, but not pushing them too hard so that they burn out.
You know, it's interesting that you say that about rest. I know we talked about that yesterday about the run rest schedules. And before we went on to record, I was looking at the chart there on Iditarod.com, and it shows that the amount of time that the teams are resting in the checkpoints. And it's really interesting because as we are right now, really early in the race, many teams are resting much less than they typically would. I would say well more than half of them are resting less than 4 hours, which is a very progressive run rest schedule at this point. And very few of them have stopped to rest for extended periods, whether it be at Yetna or Squintna or even Finger Lake. They're working their way down relatively quickly, and I think that has a lot to do with the cooler temperatures and the very well-packed trail that we saw yesterday when we headed down the river. It's just not like it has been in years past with that really punchy trail or a trail with very little snow at all. I think it's kind of a perfect condition to run a dog sled race, at least on this third of the race.
Yeah, and, it was a little bit, as we noticed, it was really, really bumpy going into Yetna, and a couple of mushers were remarking about the trail being a little bit rough on that early stage. And I think we saw that in terms of the time that the first mushers arrived in Yetna seemed to be like an hour or maybe even an hour and a half past when they usually would arrive. And it's it's very unusual to see someone who is stopped and camped before Yetnan. We saw a couple of people who were camped there at least briefly before they got to the first checkpoint. So it's very encouraging that the trail seems to be picking up and that people seem to be making up some of that time, because I was afraid in that first leg that it was going to be a very, very slow first third of the race, but that clearly is not the case.
There you go. All right, Alex, we're just about out of time. I will talk to you tomorrow. And for folks that are listening, please make sure you tell your friends about us and hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening to our podcast. It will really help out a lot. Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.